It is good to be with you guys again, and I feel like every time I come up here, I'm bringing a different confession to the table. You guys are still getting to know me. It's still my first year here at Dallas Bible. One of the confessions I need to make this morning is that I'm a recovering body painter. You guys know what I'm talking about here. This is a tame one. I removed most of the things from Facebook. We can put that down. We don't need to like keep staring at that or anything, but you guys know what I'm talking about here. There's this thing, I guess... What just happened? No. Tom, you're going to throw that up there in like the middle of the thing, aren't you, bro? Yeah, there's this thing though, like when I go to a Gator game. Okay, really? Yeah. I said I was a recovering body painter. It's in the past, okay? That is not there much anymore. But there's this thing, when I go to a game, it's like I believe that the team will do better if I'm covered in body paint. That they will feel loved and appreciated. Do they see that kind of fandom coming up? It's just something deeply ingrained in there, and it's just part of it. I remember years ago, I went with a group of my buddies. We went out to an Astros game. I grew up in the Houston area, and so the Astros are my first love, and even the bad years. I mean, the Astros had a lot of bad years, and they're kind of struggling a little bit this year and stuff, too. But we went out to a game, and of course, this is like the years when you could go down to the front row because no one was at these games and no one liked them and stuff. So this is the summer. We went out with our buddies, and we wanted to really cheer them on. There's this third baseman who's he's a rookie. He just got called up. He was really struggling. We're like, we really want to cheer this guy on and just, you know, give him a little bit of self-esteem, right? And just try to boost his day. So we went out to the outfield and we spelled out his name, Chris Truby, right? Nobody's ever heard of him. He was a struggling rookie that we just wanted to kind of boost some self-esteem in him. And so we got out there on the front row in the outfield. We're leading all these cheers every time he come to the plate. I mean, the whole outfield just erupted in applause. And I mean, we were just making his day. I was the U and Chris Truby's name that day. And the funny thing about body paint, it's an incredible sunblock. Okay? It's so... This is a day game. I had like the worst sunburn in my entire life. I go back and shower this thing off, and I've got this U branded into my chest. And I'm not kidding you, this U did not go away for an entire year. Every time I hit up the pool, I mean, there's a giant U. What's the U about? It's like it was just there for an entire year. I could not get rid of it. I even tried like sunblocking everything else around there and like laying out. It did not work. So anyway, that was a good time. He felt very special, I'm sure. Had a great day at the plate. It was a good day. Here's my question. When does love and fandom become too much? When does success and a drive for doing things with excellence cross the line into what the Bible calls idolatry? When does it become a little bit too much? When do these subtle things, these good things, end up becoming God things in our heart and our affections when we don't even really know what's going on behind the scenes? If you were with us last week, we kind of opened up this subject matter a little bit. We started talking about how idolatry is not always something that you're finding overseas, which it absolutely is. It's not always something where you're actually bowing down to a literal physical idol, but idolatry a lot of times is very often simply just making too much of good things. Very often it is simply coming before different things and functionally worshiping and functionally trusting in certain things more than you would God. It's a broad definition. It is a big definition we brought up last week. And we started to see that these are idols, that idolatry is a thing that can come up in a number of different ways where we take good things that God has blessed us with. They become God-like things. And before we know it, we're in the grips of idolatry and we're staring at it face to face and we don't even know when it's creeping in. Like, how do we know? When do we know that these good things that we love, that God has blessed us with, they've become God things and we've simply made too much of them? I think our passage this morning is going to help us in that way. So if you have your Bible, go ahead and turn to Acts chapter 19. We are going to be continuing in our series this morning, Acts chapter 19. If you're just jumping into our series, here's what we're doing. The book of Acts is telling the entire story of the beginning of the church and the spread of the gospel all around the world, right? This is where everything begins. This is where Jesus is dead, buried. He's been crucified, dead, and buried. 3 days later, he's risen from the dead. Okay, he has appeared and to his apostles and the disciples. He has trained them. He has built them up. He has sent them back out. 50 days later, the Holy Spirit comes at Pentecost. fills believers in the this early church, this early gathering, goes on from there, and they begin spreading the gospel from Jerusalem to Judea to Samaria and to the ends of the world. And so from the beginning of Acts, there is revival that is beginning to spread all throughout the ends of the world to even where we are here in Dallas today. The gospel is continuing to move forward, and Acts is telling the story of that whole thing. As we get to chapter 19, Paul has begun his third missionary journey. Okay, he's gone away from Jerusalem. They're spreading the gospel all around the world. This is his third missionary journey. It's about 20 years after Pentecost has come. At this point in time, there are tens of thousands of believers all around this area. We know from history that around the time of about 350 AD, about 300 years later, more than half, about around 55 to 60% of the Roman Empire is going to be professing believers. So this is still early on, but there are still tens of thousands of believers all around the world at this time. Very fresh, just very quickly right after the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And so Christianity is taking off at this time. In chapter 19, he's going into Ephesus. Okay, he goes into Ephesus. Ephesus is the richest city in the richest region of the Roman Empire. It's actually the region's primary port, which means all the trade comes through Ephesus, which means that it's also a very cosmopolitan city. It's also very diverse, right? All these people are coming from all around the world into this port city. They're making home for a little while, and then they're going back. So you can imagine how strategic of a place Ephesus is to be able to plant a church, right? That's what's happening here. On his missionary journey, he's establishing the church here in Ephesus. And so this is a place that's going to be central for people to come in to receive the gospel of Jesus Christ. They're going to be sent back out to their homeland. So that's what's going on here. On top of its strategic location, being cosmopolitan, being very diverse, it's also going to be home to one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, the great temple of the goddess Artemis. This place is absolutely huge. It's going to be four times the size of the Parthenon in Rome. It's absolutely enormous. The goddess Artemis was actually a fertility goddess. We have a picture of her up here. This is kind of what they would see here at this temple. This temple got a lot of fame because back in the day, a meteor actually crashed into this temple. Or not the temple there, but a meteor crashes in. They thought it looked like the goddess Artemis. And so they crafted the statue a little bit out of this meteorite. They thought it was divine, made this enormous temple around it. And the reason I bring that up is just so we know when we're talking about Ephesus and even the book of Ephesians later on, which Paul is going to write to this church after the fact, this is central in its worship, right? Artemis worship is central in its economy. It's central in its thinking. It's central in its worship. It's everywhere, right? This is one of the major things about the city of Ephesus. And so when Paul comes in and he's starting to preach the gospel that there is one God, and he's starting to preach that Jesus Christ is the risen God, it's going to create a lot of problems here for the city of Ephesus, and that's what we're going to be seeing here. At the beginning of the chapter, the same things are happening. They're going and they're preaching the gospel. There's a lot of different miracles. There's kind of this TBN kind of a scene where Paul's handkerchief is passed around, and it actually brings healing to different people, right? This is a miraculous thing where people are touching a handkerchief, and there are actually healings going on. Of course, it's not TBN. This is actually a legitimate thing. And so that is actually happening here. And the gospel continues to move forward in power. There's demonic oppression that's going on in the chapter 19. And demons are being exorcised at this time. There's a lot of activity going on. And it says here that the gospel is being amplified and Jesus is being elevated. That's where I want to pick up here in verse 17 so we know this context. It says this. This became known to all of this activity, all this gospel proclamation and Jesus being glorified. This became known to all, both Jews and Greeks who lived in Ephesus, and fear fell upon them all, and the name of the Lord Jesus was being magnified. Many also of those who had believed kept coming, confessing, and disclosing their practices. And many of those who practiced magic brought their books together and began burning them in the sight of everyone. This is like youth groups back in the day or something like that. I can imagine. And they counted up the price of them and found it 50,000 pieces of silver. Okay, so they're bringing all these things, they're burning them. 50,000 pieces of silver is worth about $7 million today. Now, this is a lot of money that's in this, right? There's a lot of money here. And it says in verse 20, so the word of the Lord was growing mightily and prevailing. About that time, there occurred no small disturbance concerning the way. Now, the way was what Christians were referred to at that time before they were actually called Christians, right? Jesus said, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. His followers were then called by other people as the followers of the way. And it says that there's no small disturbance. What we're seeing here in just a few minutes is this big, fat, just Ephesian riot that's about to break out. Verse 24, check this out. For a man named Demetrius, a silversmith who had made silver shrines of Artemis, was bringing no little business to the craftsmen. That means he's a successful guy. He's a businessman, and he's making a lot of money off of these shrines that he's making. These he gathered together with workmen of similar trades, and he said, men, you know that our prosperity depends upon this business. You see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a considerable number of people, saying that gods made with hands are no gods at all. Not only is there danger that this trade of ours will fall into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis be regarded as worthless, and that she, whom all of Asia and the world worship, will even be dethroned from her magnificence. When they heard this and were filled with rage, they began crying out, saying, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. The city was filled with confusion. Check this out. The city is filled with confusion, and they rushed with one accord into the theater, dragging along Gaius and Aristarchus, Paul's traveling companions from Macedonia. So then, verse 32, so then some were shouting one thing and some another. For the assembly was in great confusion, and the majority didn't even know for what reason they'd come together. Is that funny to anybody else? I'm reading this thing, and I'm just picturing the scene from Anchorman, like the massive like war scene in here. They're like, they have no idea even what they're doing. He's just going, loud noises. Anyway, doesn't even matter. I'm about to be fired. But they don't even know what they're there for. They're yelling certain things. They're like, I don't even know why I'm angry. Right? That's what's happening here. In the end, the crowd finally disperses. They realize they've got nothing to charge Paul's companions with. And, of course, they live to see another day. A question I want to ask is, how did this whole thing come about? All right? Why the riot? Why all the anger here? I mean, all Paul was preaching was very simply verse 26. He's saying gods made with hands are no gods at all, right? That is all he is saying. He is preaching the gospel, and he's contradicting the idolatry that he's finding in Ephesus, and he's saying gods made with hands are no gods at all. It seems pretty straightforward and obvious, right? I mean, we talked about this a little bit last week, but he's saying, okay, if you've got to fashion a god in your own image, if you've got to make a god with your hand, if you've got to paint it and clean it and do certain things for it, if you've got to make a god with your hands, that is absolutely no god at all. Why would you entrust your life? Why would you give any kind of honor and credibility to something that you've got to create yourself? It makes no sense. That's his whole argument here. I want to show us that this kind of thinking is actually a little bit closer to our American realities than I think we would originally think about. This is becoming more and more normative today. This is a video. I'm going to show a little clip of a video here. This is a video that's gone viral in the past couple weeks. I think it just came out pretty recently. At least I came up on it pretty recently. I just want you to see a little bit. Actually, hold off on that one. I'm going to bring that up in just a minute. Robert Bella, in 1985, he wrote a book called Habits of the Heart. Anybody catch this book? There's a reprint of it in 2007. He wrote a book called Habits of the Heart, in which he is going and he is analyzing American culture. He's looking at American culture, and he's trying to define what the key values of American culture are. And in this book, he talks about how one of the key driving forces behind American culture is this idea of expressive individualism. Okay, expressive individualism is this belief that an individual's highest loyalty and source of truth should be to him or herself. That's what he's looking at American culture and trying to define some of the key values. This is 1985. There's a reprint in 2007, which he continues to amplify this whole idea. But he's simply saying that this expressive individualism drives American culture. It is this belief that an individual's highest loyalty and source of truth should be to him or herself. This is the chief values that drive American culture. Do you think that that's true? Or do we see this anywhere? I want to show us a little bit of kind of where this is coming up in the conversation today. Tom, would you roll that and dim the lights a little bit?
There's been a lot of talk about identity lately, but how far does it go? And is it possible to be wrong? We went to the University of Washington to find out.
Are you aware of the debate happening in Washington State around the ability to access bathrooms, locker rooms, spas based on gender identity and gender expression?
I think people should be able to have access to the facility.
I think bathrooms could and potentially should be gender neutral because there doesn't need to be a classification for differences.
I think people definitely should have the ability to go into whichever locker room they want.
I feel like at least public universities should do their best to accommodate for those who do not have a specific gender identity.
You know, whether you identify as male or female and whether your sex at birth is matching to that, you should be able to utilize the resources.
So if I told you that I was a woman, what would your response be?
Good for you. Okay. Like, yeah.
Nice to meet you.
I'd be like, what? Really?
I don't have a problem with it.
I'd ask you how you came to that conclusion.
If I told you that I was Chinese, what would your response be?
I mean, I might be a little surprised, but I'd say, good for you. Like, yeah, be who you are.
I would maybe think you had some Chinese ancestor.
I would ask you how you similarly came to that conclusion and why you came to that conclusion.
I would have a lot of questions, just because on the outside, I would assume that you're a white man.
If I told you that I was 7 years old, what would your response be?
I wouldn't believe that immediately.
I probably wouldn't believe it, but I mean, it wouldn't really bother me that much to go out of my way and tell you, no, you're wrong. I'd just be like, oh, okay, he wants to say he's 7 years old.
If you feel seven at heart, then then so be it. Yeah, good for you.
So if I wanted to enroll in a first grade class, do you think I should be allowed to?
Probably not, I guess. I mean, unless you haven't completed first grade up to this point and for some reason need to do that now.
If that's where you feel like mentally you should be, then I feel like there are communities that would accept you for that.
I would say so long as you're not hindering society and you're not causing harm to other people, I feel like that should be a okay thing.
If I told you I'm 6 feet, 5 inches, what would you say?
That I would question.
Why?
Because you're not. No, I don't think you're 6'5".
If you truly believed you're 6'5", I don't think it's harmful. I think it's fine if you believe that. It doesn't matter to me if you think you're taller than you are.
So you'd be willing to tell me I'm wrong?
I wouldn't tell you you're wrong.
No, but I say that I don't think that you are.
I feel like that's not my place as like another human to say someone is wrong or to draw lines or boundaries.
No, I mean, I wouldn't just go like, oh, you're wrong. Like, that's wrong to believe in it. Because, I mean, again, it doesn't really bother me what you want to think about your height or anything.
So I can be a Chinese woman.
You. Sure.
But I can't be a 6'5" Chinese woman.
Yes.
If you thoroughly debated me or explained why you felt that you were 6'5", I feel like I would be very open to saying that you are 6'5", or Chinese, or a woman.
It shouldn't be hard to tell a 5'9 white guy that he's not a 6'5 Chinese woman. But clearly it is. Why? What does that say about our culture? And what does that say about our ability to answer the questions that actually are difficult?
Yeah. Okay, so that is an example of expressive individualism coming to fruition in the modern conversation today. Does anybody think that this is becoming normative in the world around us? This is everywhere. This is the way that people are thinking. This is becoming normative. Students, can I just plead for you for a second? This is not okay. Students, listen. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. They even recognize it. This is expressive individualism, that I am the highest source of my truth. That the buck stops with me. Whatever I define in myself is the end of all ends. Right? And there are bigger conversations here regarding sexuality we're not addressing even today and things like that. But students, and even we've got to be aware This is a central theme. What Robert Bella was talking about in 1985 is coming to fruition now. And this is a major way of thinking in American culture. So when this starts getting applied to the way that we think about God, what that means is that you don't have the right to tell me about God. You don't have the right to tell me who he may be, how I should worship, how I should then think, how I should then believe, where I should worship, what this whole thing should look like. No one has the right to do that because I have the right to come and create my own concept of God. Guys, we're not making this thing up. Just a number of weeks ago, actually it was a few months ago, I was out at a park in Addison and I was talking with a guy who was sitting on a bench. And I was asking him, do you consider yourself a spiritual person? And he said, yeah, absolutely I'm a spiritual person. I said, what do you mean by that? And he says, well, I think we're all spiritual people. I think that we all define our own path to God. I was like, okay, so what do you mean by that? He goes, I think just that. We all define our own path to God. We all come up with our own concept of who God is. And so I asked him a simple question. So you don't believe that there is an objective God who lives outside of your own concept or your own understanding of him. You come in and you create God and however you want to, and that becomes a legitimate form of God. And he says, yes, absolutely. I was like, do you really believe that? Do you really believe that that's how truth is, that there is no objective realities that are going on here? He's like, yeah. I go, okay, well, if I came and complimented you on your beautiful pink dress right now, would you be happy about that? And he was not wearing a beautiful pink dress. And so, he kind of chuckles a little bit right there. He's like, probably not. But that's kind of what we're talking about, right? We get to create God in our own image, right? We get to make him up in however we want to imagine him to be. We get to create this God in our own image. So let me ask this. If idolatry is functionally worshiping or functionally trusting in anything more than God, what does that make the great idol of American faith today? It's ourselves, right? One of the greatest idols that we are going to face as believers, even as we are moving forward here, is this idolatry of self. It is this idea that I am the final authority. I am the final weight on every single matter. I am loyal to myself. This creeps into the church all the time, too, guys. This is not just something that's externally happening. This creeps into the church, too. It creeps in statements like this. Well, God just wants me to be happy, doesn't he? God just wants me to be happy. And this creeps into the conversation when I'm trying to run away from something that I know God really wants, like my marriage. And we are running away from it, and we're simply saying, okay, well, God just wants me to be happy, right? He just wants me to feel good about my temporary circumstances. He wants me to be in a happy situation. He would not want me to be unhappy right now, right? And of course, what are you wrestling with here? I mean, of course, he wants you to be happy, but even more than your happiness, he wants your goodness. He wants his glory. He wants your rightness. He wants this relationship with you. Of course, he wants you happy, but it's not the end thing there. You know how fickle happiness is? Caleb is literally happy trying to run with scissors in the house and throwing him in like an electrical outlet. I mean, this kid like chases around my dog Fluffy, 6 pound. I apologize for having a dog named Fluffy, first off, but it just happened, and it's because I love my wife. It just happened, and so he terrorizes that dog. He chases him all over the house and like squeezes him. You know that cartoon, like the little cartoon, like squeezes the crud out of the little dog, and the dog's like, anyway, that is Caleb. He gets so much joy and happiness from it. Doesn't matter if it's good for him or good for the dog or good for anybody else, but he's happy in that thing. Happiness is fickle. Of course he wants your happiness. Of course he wants your joy. But the psalmist says that is in his presence is the fullness of joy. It's in his presence in the fullness is the fullness of joy. It's not running independently of him, finding it independent of who he is. In his presence is the fullness of joy. As we enter into this relationship with God, and as his life becomes true in us, he produces his life inside of a believer. Things like love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, and self-control. Those are things that being in his presence and submission to who he is, walking with the Lord, he produces those things in our life, right? In his presence is the fullness of joy. Of course he wants those things. But here's the thing, we don't trust that he knows how to bring us joy. We don't really believe it. And so we run independently and we say, okay, I know that he is saying this. I know that the God who designed the world, the God who designed me, the God who knows me from the inside out, the God who knows how I am most happy and joyful. I know those things, but I really am not trusting him in that moment. Right? God just wants me to be happy, so I'm just going to go and be independent of him. It is trickling into the church all over the place, right? He knows better than we do how to make us happen. The problem, how to make us happy. Problem is we don't always trust him. Another way it comes in is my God would never do that. And we can point to a number of different things to be able to say that, but my God would never do that. My God would never think that. My God would never act like that. My God would never have a problem with that. And it's simply coming into the conversation when our sense of justice or morality seems to be contradicted by Scripture, right? And my God would never do that. Well, my God, well, it's coming in all the time. Church, if we do not have a God who can contradict us, we do not have a God. There is no God unless he can contradict you. He spoke the world into existence. He numbered the hairs upon your head. He created you. He knows the beginning from the end. We do not have a God unless he can contradict us, right? That kind of a faith is kind of like the scene in Talladega Nights where they're praying and they're saying, dear 8-pound, 4-ounce baby Jesus, I love my baby Jesus. You know, thank you for this day. And I kind of like to think about my Jesus with a little tuxedo t-shirt because it kind of says, hey, I'm formal, but I also like to party. Right, it's you know what I'm talking about. It is this forming of God in our own image and according to our own likeness, and that's exactly what Paul is saying here in this passage. Makes absolutely no sense. Okay, gods made with hands are not gods. Gods made in our own image are not gods. Gods thought up in our own imagination according to our own value system are not gods. He's saying it's obvious, but it's not so obvious. Gods made with hands are not gods at all. So if an idol can be anything that you functionally worship or trust in more than God, that means it's going to be very, very subtle and difficult to detect, doesn't it? If idolatry is a problem of the heart, if it is a matter of the affections, taking good things and making them God things, then it means that idolatry is going to be a problem for people that is going to be very subtle and difficult to detect. It means it's going to be very easy to slip in and out of idolatry. It means it's not always going to be easy to judge in other people because idolatry is a matter of the heart. It is a matter of the affections where we are making much of good things and we're taking them to extremes. Two people can have the exact same income. They can have the exact same material possessions. They can have the exact same social status. They can have the exact same things, and yet one person could be holding those things and looking at them as idols, as things that they are trusting in, as things that they are worshiping too much in, and the other person can be sitting there worshiping the God who gave them rightly so, holding them loosely in the hands before the Lord their God. How do we know if we're slipping into idolatry? I want to give you two quick reflective questions. I think we find some from this text here. And the reason I want to bring out just reflective questions is because this is not an easy thing to determine, and this is a thing that's going to be discerned as you take these things before the Lord and you say, God, search my heart. Would you know my heart? And would you see if there's any wicked or idolatrous way inside of me? I'm bringing them to the Lord. So just two very quick reflective questions that we can that'll help us to discern if we are falling into idolatry. Number one, what do my emotions say that I value the most? What do my emotions say that I value the most? I think we see this over and over again all throughout the New Testament, but idols have this way of engaging our deepest emotions. We absolutely see it here in the text, right? Demetrius is angry. Demetrius is furious at what's going on. The mob is angry. They don't even know what they're angry about. They're just yelling things, and we're supposed to be angry, but all right, it has triggered this deep emotion inside of them. Question, what is Demetrius' idol here? What is Demetrius' idol? Money, right? He's not angry because of his love for Artemis. That comes on at the end part of this passage here. He's not angry because Artemis is primarily being defiled. He begins his speech with about how his wealth and his prosperity is going to be compromised. That's how he begins, and of course he tags it on at the end, and he says, oh yeah, and Artemis is going to be dethroned too, this great goddess Artemis that the whole entire world worships, she's going to be dethroned too. But guys, this is about our wealth and our prosperity, right? That's what he's bringing to the equation. So he is furious, and he is irate, and he's gathering this group of people there to go and to solve this problem. We've got to be paying attention to our emotions. And I want to be really careful as I say this, because I'm not saying that emotions are bad or anything that we need to overlook. What we are saying is that emotions reveal some inner realities that are going on inside of us that we may not be aware of, all right? And so very simply, we need to be paying attention to extreme emotions and saying, okay, Lord, what's behind this thing? Why am I acting? Why am I getting so angry about this thing? And I seem to be doing it over and over again. All right, why am I slipping into depression over this thing over here? And it just seems to always get me over and over and over again. Okay, and these questions we need to be bringing to the table before the Lord. Have I taken a good thing and slipped into worshiping or trusting this thing more than I do you? Years ago, this is a question that God used in my own life to really reveal something that I was holding on to. I had no idea I was holding on to it. But very simply, I think the idol of success is one that can be very strong here in Dallas, and it's not immune in the ministry world too. This was a thing that really grabbed hold of me years ago. I didn't know that it was there, and what happened was I was beginning my singles ministry out at Northwest Bible, loved it. It was great and things like that, but I had this way of coming home at the end of the night after this incredible event. And the only thing that I could see were the things that were missing or the things that were going wrong in the evening. Like, it was an incredible evening of ministry, an incredible evening of all these things that are happening. I would come home, and all I would focus on was, well, so-and-so wasn't there. This group of people weren't there. It wasn't this right amount of people. Or, we didn't have energy over here. We didn't have this. We didn't have that. And it became repetitive. For a number of weeks, I would come home and I would just, like, Kat would be like, wow, it was awesome tonight, all these kinds of things. And all I could see was the negative things that I thought felt like we were missing. And finally, Kat called me to the carpet on it. She's like, Aaron, what is up with your depression? Like, you are only seeing the things that are not happening here. What is going on deep in your heart? And I remember I had to take this thing and I had to bring it before I went and talked to Neil Tomba, the senior pastor over at Northwest. And I remember asking him, I was like, bro, here's what is happening in me. I cannot even see the good things that God is doing here because all I'm focused on is the ways that we are missing it. And we just prayed and we prayed and we prayed. And I just realized through that time that I had a very real idol of success that I was just idolizing, that, right? It was this idea that I had to have everything perfect and that everything would be wonderful. And I was idolizing it and holding on to it. It was just through realizing these high highs and these low lows that God was able to bring this to the surface and be able to see, okay, this is a very legitimate, real thing that I'm holding on to that's creating a whole lot of problems, right? We need to pay attention to these emotions and to these extreme reactions here and be able to bring them before the Lord and say, God, is there something going on behind the scenes where I am trusting in something too much, where I am worshiping something too much, and replacing you as a result? Another one that we see here is, what do you daydream about? And what do you daydream about and think that if I could only have this, then life would really begin? If I could only have this one thing, then life would really begin, right? This is a thing I'd never really understood or didn't think about for a long time, but you do not have to be rich or wealthy to have an idol of money or comfort in your life. I don't think I realized that for the longest time. What do you daydream about and think, if I could only have this thing, then life would really begin? I noticed this one years ago as well in myself. And Kat and I, we were students pretty much most of our marriage. We were students at A&M. We did seminary for a really, really long time. And so we were constantly students and just doing the drudge work. And then we were in ministry after that. So we never really had a whole lot of money or anything. And so I never thought that that would be a thing that would trip me up, that would be a thing that I would hold on to a little bit too much. I found myself driving down 635 on the way to work a lot of mornings, and you guys may have caught on to this too. They have these amazing lottery billboards. You guys seen these things? This is back in the day. I think $350 million was about as high as it went at that time. I think it's reached the billion-dollar mark at this point, but back then, it was $350 million. Every day, I would drive to work, and I'd pass that by. And I'd have this amazing prayer conversation with the Lord, and I'd be like, Lord, you know what you and I could do with $350 million? You know exactly what I'm talking about, right? You're like, we could eradicate all of the world's poverty. We could do this, right? And, of course, you just have these conversations. You're like, you and me, God, we could do this whole thing. And that's kind of how it starts off a little bit. And And it just happened where I was passing by every single day, and I found myself at work, and I found myself throughout the day, even at night, just really just dreaming and thinking a lot about what it would be like to have complete financial freedom everywhere I went. And I found that it was just, it went past this point of, okay, wouldn't that be great? Yeah, okay, let's continue to move on. But it went past to this, oh man, if we just had financial freedom, if we just had this, if we just had this, if I just had this, then things would really, really, really be okay. Brought me down in a lot of ways. I found it just occupying my mind and my heart a whole lot. And that was another thing I just kind of brought before the Lord and was like, Lord, this thing is grabbing a hold of my affections in an unhealthy way. Lord, I want to let go of this thing a whole lot. What do you daydream about and think that if I could only have this, then life would really begin? It may not be money, may not be status or anything like that for you. It may not, that may not exactly be your issue, but maybe it's getting married. Maybe it's getting out of the one that you're in. Maybe it is certain things like power or fame or the pursuit of pleasure in a lot of different ways. What are those things that you daydream about regularly and you think, if I could only have this thing, then life for me would really begin? And the reason that's a problem is because God in his presence is the fullness of joy, and he has promised us those things which we ultimately desire. How do we deal with these things? When we are recognizing that we are getting them, when we are recognizing that we are slipping into these matters of idolatry, how do we deal with them? They've got to be replaced by a greater affection. They've got to be replaced by a greater affection. Tim Keller writes about this a lot in his book, Counterfeit Gods. And he just simply says that idols cannot be removed, but idols must be replaced. And the reason that idols have to be replaced is simply because a lot of times idols are very much what we've been talking about. They're good things that have become made, that we've simply made ultimate. These are blessings that God has given us. These are relationships that God has given us. These are people and things that we need to maneuver around, which we have simply elevated too much in our affections, and we've replaced them. We've replaced God with them. They need to be replaced with greater affections. Just this past week, and we were walking around Uptown, and we had a great family day kind of out there Friday and Saturday. And I was remembering a lot of the times that Kat and I had before Caleb was born. And, you know, we had a lot more freedom at that time to be able to do what we want when we wanted. I remember at that time, all I could think about with kids coming up was, all I saw with children at that time was diapers and crying and sleeplessness. And the things that my friends and everybody kind of told me about being a young parent. And we always wanted kids and everything, but that was the only thing that I could see at that time. It was like, okay, we're not going to have a whole lot of time anymore. We're not going to be sleeping. There's diapers, there's crying, there's all these different kinds of things. And we were remembering those days. We're kind of walking through Uptown and just remembering some of that stuff. And funny thing is, Caleb comes, and the diapers come at the same time, and the crying comes. The sleeplessness comes, right? The irritability comes, and all of those things come. And yet none of that really matters because all of those things have been replaced by a greater affection, right? When Caleb comes and those things seem to be lowered and they seem to be put down in their right place because there's been a greater affection that's now in my heart than those things that I loathed earlier before. Moms, you guys know this, right? I mean, we're celebrating you today, and you guys have labored for years of your life. You've changed the diapers, you've wiped the tears, you've run errands, you've done carpools, you've cooked meals, you've worked, you've done all kinds of incredible things, and you've done so much of that, and you've not received the thanks or the gratitude in response. Actually, probably in response, you probably got a temper tantrum or some sort of just massive blow-up or something like that. You've done that for years, and yet every one of you would probably say, yeah, I would do it again. Why? Because those things have been replaced by a greater affection. You can't absolutely kill idols. You can't kill those things and put them in the back, but the way to treat idolatry is to simply replace it with a greater affection. Church, and as we were talking about what we do with idols just a little bit earlier this week, the good news of the gospel is that God has already taken care of this problem for us. He has willingly went to the cross, and he has suffered and died so that when we can come before him and we can have this open, right relationship with him where we are able to bring these things in freedom and we are able to come before him and we are able to say, God, my affections and my knowledge and my heart and all of these things have been going one direction and I want to lay them down at your feet and I want to repent of them and I want to turn from them right now. And God, in his great mercy, has saw fit to, in that place, knowing that we were going to walk in those ways, he has saw fit to give us grace and give us mercy and give us that forgiveness and that right standing with him anyway. God has already made it. He has absolutely already made it right. If we want love, Jesus is more faithful. He is more forgiving and more satisfying than the greatest romance that we've ever hoped for. If we're desiring prosperity above everything else, God in his provision, he is more reliable and secure than the fleeting promises of money. You want exhilaration? His presence is more life-giving than the greatest luxuries in the world. You want popularity? His approval is more permanent than the bipolar praise of people. You want value? To as many as have received him, to them he has given the right to be called children of God. You want security? He provides it eternally. You want companionship? He will never leave you nor forsake you. You want peace? God is the Prince of Peace. You want joy? He has created you, and he has created you for joy if you will find it in his presence. Gods made with hands are no gods at all. Gods made up in our own minds, gods concocted by our own imagination, they are no gods at all. And the good news is that as we subtly flow in and out of these things, we can recognize them, we can bring them before the God of the universe, and we can come knowing that there is grace to be received in the middle of these things. We can say, God, would you search my heart? We want to lay these things at your feet, and we can come confidently knowing that there is forgiveness to be found.